Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Canoy. And this is The Exchange. With President Trump struggling to move legislation through Congress and on track to sign more executive orders in his first 100 days than any modern president, questions inevitably arise about the balance of power in Washington. Since the founding, our president and Congress have inevitably found ways to check each other's influence under a unique system of separate institutions sharing power. Real differences also exist between foreign and domestic policy. President Trump took quick unilateral action in Syria and is warning North Korea of the same, yet he may find his tax reform package bogged down in Congress for months to come. As part of NPR's series, A Nation Engaged, we'll explore the shifting balance of power from its origins in the Constitution to its current incarnation in the Trump administration. Today on The Exchange, it's a balancing act, Congress and the President. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two guests joining me in studio for the show this morning. Chris Galdieri. He's assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College. And Chris, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks, Dean. Glad to be here.
And Dante Scala. He is associate professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire and a faculty fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. And Dante, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Dean.
I want to begin by defining terms here and talk a little bit about what we mean when we use the phrase balance of power. So just your initial thoughts when you talk about president and Congress and balance of power, what should we be thinking about? And Chris, let me start with you.
Sure. Well, I think if you go back to the debates over creating the Constitution and creating the government we have, one of the things the framers were worried about was concentrating too much power in one place. That was what they had had under England. They wanted to avoid that. And so they divided power among three different branches of government, each of them equal to the others, but each having their own spheres of responsibility. So Congress is responsible for writing laws, the president executes them, and the courts interpret them when disputes arise.
Dante.
Yeah, if you look back to, say, the Federalist Papers, right, when we look to, say, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, who were very kind of pro-Constitution, trying to convince other elites that the new Constitution was worth a try. You know, one of the chief questions was, you know, who's going to guard the guardians, right? If we create this much more powerful national government to replace the weak central government under the Articles of Confederation, who's going to keep watch over these new elites that we create in America? And will they be just like the British elites that we just got rid of? And so Madison is skeptical that the people, right, who are going to be the founders of the Constitution, he's skeptical that the people are going to be in a place to check the elites because, you know, people have their own lives and they're not all that interested in politics and so forth. And he thought it was a bad idea to keep going back to the people to redo the Constitution as a means of checks and balances. So the novel approach was, and it's laid out in Federalist Paper 51, is to have elites counter other elites, and as he memorably put it, to have ambition check ambition, mm-hmm. right? That you have all the ambitious elites in one place, but as Chris mentioned, they're in different branches, right? They're speakers of the House or Supreme Court justices or presidents, but that they would have both the means constitutionally, but also the motive, ambition, to check and balance the other branches of government.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, I want to stay with the founding for a few more minutes. And Dante, you mentioned the Federalist Papers, and that obviously is the kind, almost a sort of a debater's handbook of essentially op-ed pieces written by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. And I encourage listeners who are interested in this topic, pick up a copy. Dante, you mentioned number 51. I would say read 47 through 51, which are Madison's amazing papers defending the checks and balances system that we're talking about. And Chris, let me turn to you. You know, it's interesting. I'm always amazed whenever I read those papers that so much of the founding opposition to the founding among anti-federalists was about a fear of monarchy, that the president would become a monarch. But Madison seems to be saying in there that that you have to be just as careful about Congress, because particularly the House of Representatives, that they may manipulate public passions, public opinion, and encroach on the other branches of government. So it really is designed to kind of structurally check encroachment between these branches.
That's right. And I think if you go back and read Madison, you know, he's very skeptical. He's very leery of the House of Representatives in particular. That was the part of the government with the shortest terms, which meant it was closest to the public. It was the only part of the new government that was going to be directly elected. And so from the perspective of Madison and Hamilton, who were really worried about popular passions possibly sweeping the country and potentially empowering some sort of tyrannical legislation or activity, that was what they were worried about. That's why we have a Senate, in part, was to sort of cool down those popular passions as they came out of the House of Representatives.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, Madison is basically saying, hey, everybody's worried about the president becoming a king. Keep an eye on the House of Representatives, because they're large enough to kind of whip everybody up into a frenzy, but also kind of small enough that they may be able to use that to encroach on the other branches of government. Dante, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, it's worth noting that they saw the potentially most dangerous branch as the legislature, yeah. Right? Not the executive.
I think that surprises people.
Exactly. Not the executive, and certainly not the judiciary. I mean, they saw that as, quote unquote, the least dangerous branch, which is maybe a surprise to conservatives today who worry about an imperial judiciary and so forth. But Alexander Hamilton, who was an advocate for a strong executive, you know, had to make the case that, you know, a feeble execution of the law in the executive branch would be a bad execution of the law, and that the executive actually needed energy. And that was a profound change from the executive under what was really the first Constitution or the Articles of Confederation, because the executive under that system of government bore no resemblance to the presidency that we have today. But it's one question, and certainly in light of the present day, is did the founders see the presidency itself becoming writ large the way it is today in 21st century America? And what would they think of that?
We'll address that as well throughout the show. I want to tell listeners, we're talking about the balance of power between Congress and the presidency, and this is part of NPR's collaboration with member stations around the country called A Nation Engaged. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org, and I'll get that right here in the studio. We're talking about the historical origins of that balance, but we're also going to talk about how it's playing out in the Trump administration as well. So, gentlemen, let's jump for a moment up into the present a little bit and talk in terms of the ways we might think of balance of power in the modern context. So there's kind of a political balance of power with kind of partisanship and ideology, and then there's this structural checks and balances. And Chris, could you say a little bit about those two kinds of balance?
Sure. Well, in terms of the structural checks and balances, I think you're talking about the Constitution as written in 1787, and as I always say, you know, written in a bar in Philadelphia in 1787, and then amended since then. And so that's, you know,
those are the checks, you can sort of enumerate those.
Yeah, so you've got, you know, the Congress passes laws, but the president can veto them if he doesn't like them. The president nominates people for offices, and Congress has to confirm them. And it's basically sort of, you know, the junior high civics version of the Constitution. But then you've also got, on the political side of things, you know, you've got the development of political parties. Sometimes when the president and Congress are of the same party, people worry that the checks aren't going to work as well. If they've got the same goals, then why would the president ever worry about vetoing something that's coming from a Congress of his own party, for instance?
Dante.
Yeah, I mean, the two, you know, the interplay of partisanship and the structure of government. I mean, a lot of political scientists today worry that the Constitution wasn't built for the extremes in partisanship that we see today in modern America.
You know,
where we have, you know, red states and blue states, that is uncomfortably close to what the founders saw as the dangers of faction. Okay, Federalist Paper 10, the other famous one, right? That every
probably the most famous, right? Yeah,
that every student in Intro to American Government should read. And a faction, right, as Madison described it, was, you know, a group of citizens who are animated by passion or interest. They pursue that passion, and even to the detriment of the minority or to the common good of the entire country. And so when people look at the partisanship today and they look at how Republicans and Democrats not only differ on policy positions, but actually seem to see two different worlds. Like if you look at the economy, you know, people's perceptions of the economy varies greatly depending on whether you identify yourself as a Republican or a Democrat. And shockingly, almost the day after Trump's election, Republicans got much more optimistic about the very same economy and Democrats much more pessimistic. So the question today is, when you have those extremes, does the system of government we've created, which is really based on checks and balances and a very incremental, step-by-step approach, do those two things match up at all? And or are we really need a more democratic with a small d system than the one we've got?
Mm-hmm. And Chris Dante mentioned the issue of essentially like-minded individuals forming factions or parties. And Madison says in 10 that the primary goal of government is to mediate in a pluralistic society between these competing interests. So your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Madison was expecting there would be lots and lots and lots of factions. And one of the arguments he made in favor of the Constitution is you create a really large republic and it will make it difficult for any one faction to become too big or too entrenched or to have that much influence. And he was thinking that there would be this, you know, sort of churn of you know, factions forming and dissolving and new ones forming. To follow up on what Dante was saying, though, with modern political parties, you don't have factions coming into being and then fading away. You have sort of these two really, really large factions, and they're very entrenched, and people who belong to them, you know, it filters everything they believe in.
You're talking about parties.
Yeah,
these two big tents, as we normally call them.
That's right. And I think for a lot of Americans, that's become the dominant framework through which they see politics. And I think that's something that Madison didn't really foresee when he was writing Federalist.
Yeah, they didn't really contemplate parties in the way that, I mean, you get sort of the development of the modern party system with Thomas Jefferson, and he leans pretty heavily on his party leaders in Congress. And it was pretty nasty back then, too, but but it's very different from where they were initially. Yeah, Dante?
Yeah, I think political party, I mean, the parties are uncomfortably close to faction in the minds of the founders. But nonetheless, right, Madison and Hamilton find themselves in opposite political parties a decade after the Constitution is formed. And just getting back to the presidency for one second,
sure.
The idea of the presidency as a national figure or as the head of a political party is something that perhaps the framers did not contemplate. I mean, even, you know, let alone Donald Trump, Andrew Jackson was a long way in the future in the 1780s, and it's worth noting that, you know, Trump and Jackson are often seen in parallel, and Jackson was seen at the time as someone who was something very different.
An outsider, a populist, kind of a man of the people.
A demagogue, right?
Yeah, poking the Washington establishment in its eye, really.
Exactly. But that was a faraway dream for 1780s.
Yeah, you mentioned Chris, I'll turn back to you, but you mentioned the founders' perception conception of the presidency, and I would encourage people who have a copy of the Federalist Papers to read 67 through 77, which is where Hamilton lays out most of the presidential design. And Chris, he really talks about needing somebody who is kind of insulated, above the fray, and I think he even uses the phrase who can resist the temporary delusions of the masses. It's just, and the president, as Dante is saying now, this current balance of power, it's a very different institution than what they had contemplated in some respects.
Yeah, that's right. If you go back to reading the Federalist Papers on the presidency, you sort of get this sense of the president as a national figure who's, I think, as you said, you know, above the fray, someone who, if Congress is seized by, you know, some political passion or mania and starts passing crazy legislation, can veto it, can be a check on that branch of government. But they really didn't envision the idea of a president who would be, you know, a national leader, who would be the person who sets the agenda for politics the way that presidents do today. And I think that's something that would really be surprising to them.
Yeah, Dante.
Yeah, I mean, the presidency in the 1780s was seen, except in cases of national emergency, as Chris mentioned, like the commander-in-chief. But in normal times, the president was basically the chief clerk, right? Mm-hmm. And he was the chief clerk of an organization, the national government, that was not expected to be all that powerful. I mean, the real action was going to take place still at the level of the states to a considerable degree. So the idea of the presidency today, the modern presidency, where the economy, you know, basically is assessed to the president for blame or credit, that idea was far away, you know, from the mindset of the framers in the 1780s.
Yeah, and we're going to talk in a little bit about the 20th century and some of the big developments in the presidency during the Great Depression and World War II. And Dante, you mentioned, and I'll turn to you, Chris, this idea initially of the president as commander-in-chief, what they used to call, I guess, the pragmatic exception rule, that you want to kind of repel attack. But that's basically it. And we'll talk a little bit about how that is very different than it once was. But Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think when you go back and read Hamilton on the presidency, there's a real tension there, because on the one hand, he's saying, well, you know, this office isn't that powerful. People don't have to worry about the president turning into a tyrant or turning into a monarch. Yeah. On the other hand, the president needs to be independent. The president needs to have a lot of energy. The president needs to have the capacity to act quickly in times of emergency or times of strife, for instance, an invasion or some other disaster that might befall the country. And I think, you know, as much as we look at the modern presidency and say this is really, you know, evolved from what was envisioned in 1787, you can sort of see the seeds of the aspects of the modern presidency back there. Mm-hmm. I don't know that Hamilton would, you know, look at modern presidents and say, yes, that's exactly what I had in mind. But, you know, in his writing, you know, there's definitely, you know, room for presidents to exercise that kind of power.
Yeah, and Dante, you mentioned the idea of the presidency as kind of a clerkship or an administrative office. I think political scientists sometimes call this the Whig theory of government. I think people are often surprised to learn that Congress was really sort of the dominant institution in the 19th century. It's really not till the sort of the big world wars and the Great Depression that the president is ascendant in this, that the balance of power really kind of shifts in the president's favor.
Yeah. And, you know, Hamilton was seen, you know, Chris points out exactly why Hamilton was seen as so controversial and was so unliked in certain circles in the 1780s and 1790s, because his vision of the executive was a much more modern one than they had in mind or were comfortable with back then. So he was very much, you know, an outlier, I think, in the whole scheme of things, despite the fact that, you know, now we see him, especially, you know, with the musical, as, you know, as the founder in some ways. But it's fair to say that there was a broad spectrum of thought, and Hamilton was kind of on one end of things, and people were concerned, you know, even with Washington by the end of his second term, about kind of monarchical tendencies in the executive.
Yeah, and Chris, this is what we often refer to as the vesting clause in Article II, which establishes the presidency in the Constitution. The idea that the president, in comparison to Congress, which has these enumerated set of powers, and if you look at Article I, it's much longer than Article II. But Article II, it's very sort of opaque about kind of the limits of presidential power. And I think Dante is suggesting, and we certainly see it in the modern president, there's a lot of wiggle room there for unilateral action. And you say, well, you know, I took an oath to defend the Constitution, so I can make this unilateral move on foreign policy, on the bank, et cetera.
That's right. In Article II, you've got the vesting clause. Article I vests very specific enumerated powers in Congress. Article II just vests the executive power in the president. Article II says the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And beginning around the turn of the 20th century, you started to see a lot of presidents looking at those and saying, so that's, I've got some justification to do things here that, you know, Congress might not have passed a law, there might not be a specific constitutional provision, but I'm fulfilling my oath by doing this.
Yep, and we're going to talk shortly about how that all plays out in the modern presidency with President Trump, Obama, Bush, etc. But coming up, more on the balance of power between Congress and the presidency, part of NPR's collaboration with member stations around the country called The Nation Engaged. Stay with us. It's The Exchange. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis, and today we're taking part in an NPR collaborative project called A Nation Engaged. Stations around the country are discussing presidential power. We're looking at the checks and balances on presidential power, particularly those involving Congress. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, all one word. I have two guests with me in studio for the hour, Dante Scala. He's associate professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire and a fellow at UNH's Carsey Institute, and Chris Galdieri, assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College. Chris specializes in presidential politics. So, gentlemen, before the break, we were kind of laying a foundation for some of the ways in which the balance of power, as defined in the Constitution, has started to shift over time. You know, congressional dominance in the 19th century, the rise of a more powerful executive in the 20th century, and we'll talk about world wars and the Great Depression. But let's spend some time now talking about the current president and the current balance of power, both political and institutional. Talk a little bit about how it's playing out. And your initial thoughts, Chris.
Well, I think what we're seeing is one of the side effects of electing someone as president who comes from completely outside the political sphere. You get the feeling watching Trump on the campaign trail and then during the transition in his early months of the presidency that he's really focused on those sort of outward public-facing parts of the job, giving the State of the Union address, having a press conference with foreign heads of state. But those aren't the job. Those are like the, in many ways, the least substantive parts of the job. And I think he's really had to become aware of the fact that Congress is its own independent branch of government, that Congress is not going to pass a bill just because he says pass a bill, that, you know, on the health care repeal, for instance, that you could have a situation where a Republican speaker with a Republican majority can't get groups within that majority to agree on a bill. And I think, you know, that's cost him a lot of time and it's cost him a lot of momentum. You know, coming out of the election, I think everyone was in shock by this upset victory. And thinking, wow, is this going to continue after January 20th? Well, you know, we just see Trump just roll up one win after another win after another win. But what's turned out to be more important is the fact that he only has 52 Republican votes in the Senate, that the Republicans in the House only have about a 20-vote margin.
So that's sort of a political balance of power rather than sort of the classic institutional checks and balances. And Dante, you know, as I listened to Donald Trump on the campaign trail, and, you and I have been covering this for many years, and we've heard a lot of candidates make a lot of promises. You really got the sense that, you know, as he was making these promises, I was thinking, okay, but that's not exactly how the system works, and this is going to be very challenging for you should you win the presidency. And that's essentially what has happened, that sort of his whole conception of how the federal government functions to produce policy outputs was really kind of a much more sort of a top-down kind of unitary model rather than this joint enterprise between the president and Congress.
Yeah, I think that's true. And certainly when we look at where Trump has intersected with Congress or tried to persuade Congress, as Chris mentioned, especially with health care, you know, two cheers for balance of power and two cheers for pluralism, at least, that we saw, you know, the majority Republican Party actually has a lot of minority factions within it that aren't all necessarily going to jump onto the Trump bandwagon. All that's true. However, where Trump has succeeded so far is in precisely the aspects of the kind of so-called unitary presidency. Mm-hmm. If you look at, for example, his use of executive orders to roll back the executive orders of the previous president.
A lot of sort of regulatory rollback activity.
I mean, if you are a Republican or a Trump supporter who thinks that too much is being made of climate change and that was being used by the national government to put excessive regulations on businesses, you're very happy with Donald Trump at this point. If you think that immigration is, especially illegal immigration, is a big problem, you're happy with how Donald Trump is using the executive branch. So I think internally, within the branch, Trump has had successes, but certainly interacting with, well, at least with Congress, because the other chief success, of course, is the nomination of Gorsuch to the Supreme Court.
We'll talk absolutely. We're going to talk about confirmation. Let you, Dante, you mentioned health care. I think that's a great way to kind of assess some of the balance of power issues. Let's listen to Donald Trump addressing the failure of the GOP health care bill.
We all learned a lot. We learned a lot about loyalty. We learned a lot about the vote-getting process. We learned a lot about some very arcane rules in, obviously, both the Senate and in the House. So it's been, certainly for me, it's been a very interesting experience. But I like Speaker Ryan. He worked very, very hard. A lot of different groups. He's got a lot of factions. And there's been a long history of liking and disliking, even within the Republican Party, long before I got here. But I've had a great relationship with the Republican Party. It seems that both sides like Trump, and that's good. So I'm disappointed. I'm a little surprised, to be honest with you.
That's Donald Trump addressing the failure of the GOP's attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Chris, that was sort of the perfect piece of sound in terms of the education of Donald Trump. He mentioned the competing institutions. He mentioned factions. A lot of the stuff we've been talking about so far in the show.
Yeah, I mean, what was amazing to me about the health care failure back in March is that they spent about 3 weeks on it. This is something that has been, you know, the top of the Republican policy wish list since the day the Affordable Care Act was signed in 2010. When you finally have a Republican president and a Republican Congress, you know, talk to a Democrat the day after the election, they were convinced that Obamacare was toast. And then they get into office and they deal with it in a really half-hearted way. There was no effort to involve congressional committees. There was no effort to involve stakeholders in healthcare policy, to bring in insurance companies, medical associations, those sorts of folks. And I think when you approach legislating like that, that's the result you get. You get sort of something that's thrown together behind closed doors late at night and is really unpopular and people don't want to vote for.
We're talking about the balance of power today on The Exchange, the balance of power between the president and Congress. It's part of NPR's collaboration with member stations around the country called A Nation Engaged. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, as many of you do. And let us know, what do you think about the current balance of power and how things are playing out between the president and Congress? Are there any episodes from recent or earlier history that kind of fit in with this topic? Feel free to call in and let us know. And I want to kind of present the sort of the political aspect of the balance of power around healthcare by listening to some sound from Mark Meadows, who is the head of the Republican Freedom Caucus. This was this group of conservatives in the Congress who really turned out to be a bit of a problem for President Trump.
You know, I'm with the American people, Jake, and you know that. I'm a straight shooter, and what happens is if it's a bad bill, whether it's on our side of the aisle or the Democrat side of the aisle, I'm going to stand with the American people. And Donald Trump and I are not at odds. We want to make sure that we repeal the Affordable Care Act and replace it with something that drives down health care costs and insurance premiums, and this doesn't do it, Jake. And so, you know, when you put those slides up, that doesn't do anything to compel people to look at this. These are principled decisions. We have to have an honest debate and hopefully negotiate to get to a place where there's 218 votes in the House.
The Jake in that clip was Jake Tapper of CNN, and that was Mark Meadows, a Republican Freedom Caucus chairman, talking about the challenges facing the health care bill. And Dante, we've talked about kind of a political balance of power, and that was an example of where President Trump had to deal both with these conservatives, as represented by Meadows, and also this other group of moderates called the Tuesday Group, which are other sort of more moderate Republicans in the Congress. And it made it almost impossible to sort of put together a coalition.
Yeah, and the difficulty arises if you satisfy the demands of the one group, the more moderate group, you were losing votes on the other side among those very conservative Republicans. And also, if we kind of expand a bit further beyond Congress, if we just think about the fact that we have a federal system with state governments having significant power, another group at the table in this very pluralistic Republican Party, Republican governors who may or may not have expanded Medicaid in response to...
Some did, some didn't, right.
Exactly. But they were home thinking about their constituents, and they had a very different view of Obamacare, perhaps, than, say, Speaker Ryan did or Freedom Caucus Republican did. So it was a very difficult kind of mix to all to, you know, all very pluralistic, all to satisfy. And, you know, as we know, throughout American political history, it's a lot more difficult to undo an entitlement, you know, especially even if it's only been in place for a few years.
Because you build a constituency, essentially, both in the bureaucracy and then also out in the general public. Yeah, Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, and with healthcare, I mean, messing with healthcare is one of the most terrifying things a politician can do. Democrats learned that in 2010, and I think Republicans started to figure that out this year. People are always worried about losing whatever healthcare they've got, no matter how expansive or not it is. And so when the CBO came out with a score on the healthcare bill that suggested something, I don't remember if it was 10 or 14 or 24 million people could lose their insurance, you know, you can be a very conservative Republican and still your ears will perk up when you hear a number like that.
Yeah, Dante.
I mean, one thing to keep in mind is, I mean, if we think back 100 days to some of the forecasts about a Trump presidency, and there were a lot of political scientists concerned about American authoritarianism, right? That this would be a president who would be truly autocratic, and that basically that the American system of government was rotting from the inside, and that the balance of power that Madison and Hamilton set up would all crumble. So far, at least, I think there's again, kind of two cheers for checking and balancing here, that we're not seeing that occur. I mean, you can point to certain aspects that are troubling of the Trump presidency, no question about it. But, you know, is this all too unexpected for a president who's sitting at 42% approval in the country, that he's had about the amount of success that he's had so far?
Yeah, and Chris, Dante mentions public opinion. I mentioned it a bit earlier as well. It can have a big impact on balance of power. There's a lot of research out there that shows that, you know, unpopular presidents will often find a very resistant Congress because there are fewer electoral consequences in not going along with the wishes of the president.
That's right. When a president's approval rating goes down, members of Congress are not afraid to cross them or ignore them. Courts are more willing to overturn their decisions or rule against them. And other people in Washington, whether they be lobbyists, whether they be activists, people in the bureaucracy, they just generally feel fewer compunctions about not towing the presidential line. And to the extent that Trump has, you know, pretty quickly slid into the low 40s, high 30s and stayed there, that's another thing that's hampering his ability to get things done. On health care, you know, there were very few members of Congress in the Republican caucus who were really worried about the prospect of Trump campaigning against them or calling for a primary challenge or something, simply because they figured that, you know, they ran ahead of him in their district last year and they'll probably do better than him in 2018.
And it's interesting, Dante, there was a moment there in the coverage of the health care debate where people were focused on the idea that Trump may seek some kind of retribution by campaigning in the districts of certain members of Congress who did not go along with him among the Republicans. And then that they seemed to sort of back the administration seemed to kind of step back from that a little bit.
Yeah. And Trump, you know, when that passage that you ran, mm-hmm. talk, you know, Trump sounded like a team player, you know, in terms of, you know, he didn't single out Speaker Ryan for special criticism. You know, he hasn't called for him to be deposed in the wake of the, you know, the failure of the health care bill. So there's, you know, it's been interesting to see, you know, how, you know, one question about the Trump presidency, and it's too early to say, you know, is there a learning curve for the Trump administration, right? And, you know, certainly we've seen other presidencies, you know, Bill Clinton's comes to mind, which were just disasters coming out of the gate, and yet that turned out to be a fairly successful presidency. So one question is, you know, can Trump learn and adapt, or is he really just, you know, tweeting and so forth? And but does he have people with him in his administration who can learn It's a
fair question. And Chris, Dante mentioned Bill Clinton. And if you look at the kinds of coalitions that Clinton assembled to pass the North American Free Trade Agreement, to pass welfare reform, we used to call that triangulation. You bring in some sort of moderates from here and some people on the other side of the aisle, even if your own party is not particularly happy with you. I remember with the Welfare Act, he got a lot of pushback from liberals, and he said, well, let's do this and we can go back and fix what we don't like later. Can you even conceive of Trump? You know, there's a lot of talk about, well, maybe Trump could work with Democrats on health care or maybe on infrastructure. Do you think he can pull off the same kind of balancing act that Clinton did on those particular pieces of legislation?
I think there's a possibility of that happening. And I'd go back to something else from the sound clip you played earlier where he talked about my relationship with the Republican Party has been good. And that really struck me because it was a reminder that, you know, Donald Trump did not spend, 20 years coming up through the Republican Party. When he last time he thought about running for president in 2000, he was thinking about running as a Reform Party candidate. So I can envision a world like, let's say that the 2018 election goes really badly for Republicans. I could see a world where Trump pivots. Sorry for using the word Trump pivot, everyone. But where Trump says, all right, I'm going to reach out to Democrats. I'm going to act like a deal maker now. I don't know that Democrats would be in a receptive mood if that were the case.
It just seems like a different, in terms of balance of power, it just seems fundamentally different. Yeah, Dante?
Yeah, I mean, that's, Chris is right. I mean, one key difference between where Trump stands now after 100 days versus, say, Obama or any of his predecessors, really, is the degree of enmity that the opposing party feels toward him. I mean, Obama at this point, even though wasn't popular among Republicans, he was more popular among Republicans at this point than Donald Trump is among Democrats. So you can imagine the pressure that there would be on a Democratic legislator, say, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer from New York. How many calls would he get from Democratic activists in his offices if he's cutting a deal with Donald Trump? Because Democrats are certainly, over the next few years, they're all about resistance among the activist class. They're not about, let's cut a deal and cooperate with this president.
Mm-hmm. Chris, Dante mentioned earlier the issue of executive orders, and Sue from Alexandria emailed us just a better understanding of executive orders. What are the limits? I mean, Trump really gravitated towards the idea of signing these things and, then he can roll back regulations, but he seems to prefer that to actually having to deal with the legislative process.
Yeah, and that's not surprising, again, given, that Trump's a political outsider, it comes from outside the political system, that he would focus on these things that he can do himself. He doesn't need to deal with the bureaucracy. He doesn't need to deal with Congress. He doesn't need to deal with a foreign leader who has their own agenda. But, there are limits to what you can do with executive orders. We saw Barack Obama, for instance, try to use them very aggressively and very expansively, especially in his second term, and he ran into a fair amount of resistance from the courts. And I think we're seeing Trump encounter the same thing, whether it be with the travel ban, whether it be with the funding for sanctuary cities policy that was blocked in court, I believe, last night. Some executive orders are, using authority that's designated by a piece of legislation that Congress passes. When presidents do that, they're on very firm ground. Some of them are about how the executive branch does its business, what requirements federal contractors have to meet in order to get contracts and that sort of thing. And those are generally fine. But, when presidents are pushing the limits or trying to do something a bit expansive, I think that's when they're going to run into trouble.
Coming up, we're going to talk more about the balance of power between the president and Congress. We'll talk about Supreme Court confirmations, a little bit about the wall and foreign policy as well. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hi, my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today we're looking at the balancing act between presidential and congressional power, part of the NPR series A Nation Engaged. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. All one word. I have two guests in studio with me for the remainder of the show. Chris Galdieri is assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm. Dante Scala is associate professor of political science at UNH and a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. Gentlemen, I have a couple emails here I want to go through. Augustus from Durham emailed us, and he raises an interesting point. We've been using the phrase balance of power. People who study foreign policy also use that phrase to kind of discuss the balance of power between nations. I think earlier in the show, we tried to draw a distinction between the separation of powers, which are these sort of structural checks and balances. But then the balance of power is sort of the balance of political power in Washington. So I think that's kind of the way in which we are using that phrase. One other area in which President Trump seems to have encountered the separation of powers, the political balance of power being trickier to negotiate than perhaps he expected, is on immigration and the wall that he would like to build. So let's take a listen to him talking to Congress. This is his congressional address and what he has to say about building that wall.
At the same time, my administration has answered the pleas of the American people for immigration enforcement and border security. By finally enforcing our immigration laws, we will raise wages, help the unemployed, save billions and billions of dollars, and make our communities safer for everyone. We want all Americans to succeed, but that can't happen in an environment of lawless chaos. We must restore integrity and the rule of law at our borders. For that reason, we will soon begin the construction of a great, great wall along our southern border.
That is President Trump addressing Congress about getting tough on immigration and building what I believe he said was a great, great wall. Dante, let me turn to you. This is another example of where both the separation of powers and the need to go through the legislative process to get funding and the balance of power in terms of sort of the partisan balance in Washington has really sort of complicated things for President Trump.
It has. I mean, certainly, in the past week, President Trump was at one point threatening to, have a showdown over keeping the government open in order to get, money for the wall and so forth. And he's backed off of that. So, but on the other hand, again, if you're a Trump voter for whom immigration was a big concern, I think you're pleased by what you've seen so far, by what the president has done within his sphere of authority, which is, again, the executive branch executing the law enforcement. Right. I mean, he's put a lot of immigration or, advocates of reducing immigration into his administration. He has an attorney general who's very keen on stopping illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, arguably there have been some results because, unauthorized border crossings are down, according to the government, down significantly. Now, is that a blip? Could be, right? It's only been 100
right.
days or so.
Right.
But there's reason to think that Trump is, again, within his sphere of authority, within the branch, is executing his promises. But when it's trying to get something done that requires additional funding, that's where he's running into the same legislative dilemma that we saw with healthcare.
Yeah. And Chris, I want to add to that. You know, obviously the issue with the wall is he wanted this roughly $1 billion or so. But that's the power of the purse. And to get that money, he has to go through congressional appropriations. And we're dealing with the potential for a government shutdown in a few days, although they may do a short-term fix and then negotiate at greater length. Let me fold in one additional issue that touches on the power of the purse. We had an email from Mike referring to the recent I think it was just yesterday, the Ninth Circuit decision on Trump's order to keep money from sanctuary cities. Another example where the judge said that's the power of the purse. You don't get to control that.
That's right. And I think the judge also, made the distinction between using federal funding to encourage policy, for instance, raise your drinking age to 21 or we'll slightly cut your highway funding, versus using it coercively. And that's what the Roberts Court argued that the Affordable Care Act did with Medicaid expansion.
Right. And Dante, that sort of feeds into this whole issue of being able to do things within the executive branch in terms of controlling the flow of funds versus having to get new money through Congress.
Right. I mean, laws have, immigration laws haven't changed. And that's a key point in terms of, the 20th century and now, Congress has delegated a lot of authority to the president. Congress passes laws and essentially says to the president, now you take care of this.
You
enforce the laws. Yeah. And the power of enforcement, the contrast between, say, President Obama and President Trump, on executing the laws and enforcing the laws on the books, can lead to dramatically different outcomes in policy without Congress doing a single thing.
So it sounds like you're saying that Trump encountered some of the challenges of the separation of powers, the balance of political power in Washington, is finding his lane in terms of how to get some things done.
Yep, exactly. And that lane is right in, the sweet spot of executive power, which other presidents have enjoyed, right? It's, it's one thing to make a law, but something else to interpret the law as, not on the books, but mm-hmm. as it's actually going to happen in the real world.
And Chris, let me turn to you and let's shift to foreign policy. We see some real differences between the separation of powers and presidential power and foreign policy compared to domestic policy. This famous article that we all read in grad school called The Two Presidencies by Waldavsky, written in the 60s, that presidents tend to have a lot more flexibility in foreign policy. And you can trace a lot of that to the powers that were built up with two world wars and president kind of being center stage during the Cold War.
That's right. For most of American history, foreign policy was not a pressing concern. We were separated from Europe by the Atlantic Ocean. We had the Pacific Ocean on the other side. We had very, chill relations with Canada. It wasn't until after World War II that, presidents really had this sort of permanent standing authority when it came to foreign policy that Congress was not interested in dealing with. Basically, the way things are structured, presidents have a lot of advantages over Congress when it comes to foreign policy, and particularly when it comes to military engagements. And Congress has been fairly content with that. Every once in a while, for instance, after the Syria strike, you would hear people like Rand Paul or Tim Kaine say, exactly when did Congress authorize this action? But for the most part, the other 98% of Congress is very happy to just let presidents deal with that on their own.
Yeah. Dante, you want to jump in?
Yeah. I mean, it's, the recent, missile launch at Syria and so forth, just one more example of Congress basically sleeping on the job when it comes to actually being a partner in foreign policy. And that goes back now, for decades. And that's, not much has changed in that regard, whether it's President Trump in Syria or President Obama with Libya and Yemen. Congress seems very content. That's why it's only two cheers, not three cheers for balance of power, because foreign policy, Congress seems very content to give presidents, even this one, a very long leash.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a listen to Senator Rand Paul. He is sort of a little bit of an outlier in this. He was giving some advice to President Trump about dealing with some of these foreign policy conflicts.
I guess what I've been more concerned is not the military aspects of the mission or even whether or not it will have any significance. My concern has been mostly that this is an inappropriate way to begin a war, that the Constitution says war begins with a vote in Congress. And that even George Bush, who was often treated mercilessly by the media as being so far out there, he came to Congress and asked to have to go to war against the Taliban and those who attacked us on 9/11. He also did the same in Iraq. And so I think this is a wrongheaded notion that we just skip the most important step, and that is whether or not we should go to war.
That's Senator Rand Paul telling CNN why he disapproves of President Trump's order to launch airstrikes against Syria following a chemical weapons attack. He called it a wrongheaded approach. And Logan from Exeter emails us and asks about the separation of powers and the ability to declare war and the idea that Congress is routinely abdicating its constitutional duty to declare war. We know from the Constitution, the president's the commander in chief, Congress declares war. We haven't had a declaration of war, I think, since World War II, really. So what's the impact of all of this on balance of power, separation of power?
Well, it means that, first of all, presidents have enormous latitude to act when it comes to foreign policy and when it comes to military action. The other is that presidents often retreat to foreign policy and military action when the rest of their agenda is stuck in the mud.
I use an article in my class called, I think it's an article by Dan Dresner who's at Tufts, about how presidents learn to love, why presidents learn to love foreign policy.
Yeah, exactly, because Congress doesn't care.
Right, and you can act unilaterally.
And also, you know, if you're a president who's concerned about visuals, as some presidents are more than others, foreign policy always looks good. You get to have that, you know, that press conference where you're next to the Prime Minister of Great Britain or the President of France or whatever, and it's a really good visual. And you go overseas, and very often you get adoring. I mean, Richard Nixon got adoring crowds in South America at the height of Watergate because it's an American president. That's amazing, and that's a good picture.
Yeah, Dante, and I will say, and we'll get your thoughts on this, but you can go back to, you know, Reagan with Grenada, Bush the Elder with Panama, Clinton in Kosovo. Take your pick. A lot of times presidents will say, you know, hey, you've already ratified our involvement in the UN or NATO or whatever treaty. I don't need to come back to you for a second vote. You increasingly see that justification, and they believe they have the right to kind of at least initially do this unilaterally.
Right. And Congress is a willing co-conspirator with all this because I guess I disagree a bit with Chris. I'm not sure that members of Congress don't care about foreign policy, but they care more about being reelected, which means they don't want to take responsibility. And going back to the discussion, you know, the framers had about this, you know, on the one hand, the executive is set up so that when a war occurs, when a crisis occurs, you have one person in charge. You don't want Congress in charge of running a war. We learned that during the Revolutionary War, right? You want an executive in charge.
Just all kinds of collective action problems, mm-hmm. conflicting articulation of policy, listening to different people in Congress.
However, getting to that place where we use military action, you know, the framers understood that war has all sorts of unintended consequences that are not at all clear when the war begins. And certainly we've learned that over the last decade and a half all over again to some extent. And therefore, there needs to be – what Congress does do well is deliberate about all the possible consequences before taking action. But now we have a system where Congress is perfectly happy to sit back, let the president take action, and then – the nation has to deal with consequences, which we may not see.
Congress, in theory, can cut off funding, but once the troops are in harm's way, they're not going to back away from funding these. You know, you get these supplemental requests from the president for additional money. One issue we haven't talked about yet, and Amy on Facebook brings this to our attention, is the issue of checks and balances, separation of powers, as it regards the Supreme Court nomination. And we just went through this whole drama with Merrick Garland, Obama's nominee, who couldn't get a hearing or a vote. We now have Justice Gorsuch. This really underscores that where sort of the partisan balance of power collides with the separation of powers. Chris?
Yeah, that's right. And I think what we saw within hours of Justice Scalia passing away last year was a statement from Mitch McConnell that no Obama knee would ever sit on the court. And essentially, they made a very high-stakes gamble that they could take no action, not pay any electoral price for it, and hold the seat open for a Republican president should one win the 2016 election. And it worked. And fortunately for Mitch McConnell and fortunately for other Republicans, Donald Trump picked somebody that you could expect any other Republican president to have picked. You know, Gorsuch is, you know, pretty much you could imagine Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or any other Republican president picking him. I think the question mark a lot of people had during the a lot of Republicans were worried about during the campaign was, well, what if he gets in and he picks somebody, you know, what if he decides to put Ivanka on the Supreme Court or something, or make some really left field choice, or pick somebody who's a very moderate judge? But, you know, Trump didn't do that, and that worked out for them.
Yeah. And to, you know, the icing on the cake for all that is that the debate over Gorsuch spawned the, you know, the extension of the so-called nuclear option,
right,
which without getting too deep into the weeds means that going forward, you know, only a majority will be needed in the Senate to confirm Trump's perhaps next appointment, which could be really significant.
Yeah. I mean, it could lead to a polarization of the court, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're a Democrat sitting at home, imagine if Justice Ginsburg or Breyer departs the court and Trump puts a second Gorsuch, okay, very solidly conservative, young, for the next generation. I mean, that for conservatives, that's the dream. I mean, Trump presidency would be a success just based on that alone.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to mention that as part of our Nation Engaged collaboration, NHPR will air an On Point special tomorrow at 11 a.m., which will be a discussion focused on how powerful should any American president be. Well, gentlemen, we are just about out of time. I think we're all going to be watching to see President Trump negotiate the separation of powers and also the balance of power, which obviously is having an impact. But as I think both of you have mentioned, he's really kind of learning on the job, sort of where he can make some progress and where he's potentially going to run up against these longstanding roadblocks. But as I said, we are out of time, and I'd like to thank both of you. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Anytime, Dean.
That's Chris Galdieri, assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College. And Dante, it's always good to see you.
You're welcome, Dean. Pleasure.
That's Dante Scala, associate professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire and a faculty fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. And remember, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.